SNI Digital Innovations in Learning, is pleased to present, in association with SNI Surgical Neurology International, another in the series of SNI Digital Controversies in Spine Surgery, a lecture and discussion with Nancy Epstein, who is the Editor-in-Chief of Surgical Neurology International, on the topic of diagnosis and treatment of thoracic disc herniations. Nancy is the Professor of Clinical Neurosurgery at the School of Medicine at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, has been in practice for 40 years doing spine surgery, is the Editor-in-Chief of Surgical Neurology International. This is another in the series of talks on diseases of the spine and neurologic involvement by Nancy Epstein. And this one is on the diagnosis and treatment of thoracic disc herniations, a very troubling subject for many neurosurgeons who have handled it. So, Nancy, go ahead.
Thank you, Jim. Yes. The diagnosis and treatment of thoracic disc herniations becomes very specific because it has to be tailored to where that disc herniation originated from. So pathologically, anatomically, MRCT, et cetera, you're looking for the large central disc herniations, you're looking for the large anterolateral disc herniations seen here, and then you're looking for the very lateral and or foraminal disc herniations, because it's going to be completely different as to how you may approach some of these. Just looking at the anatomy, we're all familiar with, ventrally you have the vertebral body and you have the annulus fibrosus, nucleus pulposus located centrally, and then lateral to this in the thoracic spine, you have the rib as it is anastomosed to the thoracic vertebral body. You have the thoracic pedicle. You then have the lamina posteriorly, but you also have the transverse process as it affixes to the rib laterally. So all of this anatomy is very specific to the thoracic spine, and it becomes crucial to understand that when essentially understanding and seeing what the different approaches happen to be. Just emphasizing the anatomy anteriorly, yes, here's the anterior longitudinal ligament, the vertebral bodies. Here is your head of the rib being affixed to the lateral thoracic spine, and then posterior, your lamina, your spinous processes, and obviously your transverse processes that are basically anastomosed to that rib laterally. And here's just a figurative diagram of the thoracic spine, T1 to 12, looking at the anterior and posterior portions of the vertebral body, the spinal canal where the spinal cord is living, and then dorsally, the spinous processes and lamina. So what are your options for thoracic disc herniations? Well, the lateral disc, the transpedicular approach was really devised to deal with this very specifically and very focally. Anterolateral thoracic discs, you're going to need a costotransversectomy or a lateral extracavitary approach. And for anterior central thoracic discs, you can use the lateral extracavitary or the anterior transthoracic procedure. And here's just a brief summary of what these approaches are going to show you. Here's your lateral thoracic disc herniation, and here is your illustration of the transpedicular approach. You know, you're not doing a, quote, laminectomy here. You're actually just exposing enough bone to expose the pedicle to then do the transpedicular resection. Then for your anterolateral discs, you're going to have a costotransversectomy as your option, where you're going to remove the transverse process as it affixes to the rib, the pedicle, and also where the head of the rib anastomoses to the thoracic vertebral body.
So before you go on, Nancy, and even all the back and forth we've done, how common are in the disc pathology and the spine? How common are thoracic discs?
It's like 1 out of 1,000.
Oh, it's really low.
Yeah, the frequency of, you know, your lumbar disc is obviously the highest. About 10% of those are going to be cervical discs, and thoracic discs are really quite rare. Like 1 in 1,000 is basically the figure that we're typically given. Obviously, you can see these that are asymptomatic on MRs and CAT scans, but the symptomatic ones are rare. This is
Okay.
just, again, to illustrate the costotransversectomy, where you're doing a combination of removal of the ribs, or removal of the pedicle rather, and a portion of the vertebral body with the head of the rib, and then a portion of the rib itself. Anterolateral or anterior central disc herniations, the extracavitary approach can be used also for this. Now, what makes it extracavitary? Because not only you're doing what you're going to do with the costotransversectomy, but essentially you're also taking out the vertebral body laterally, which means that you have to peel away the pleura from the lung in order to have this lateral exposure of the vertebral body. And again, all of your dissection has to be with a downbiting curette away from the canal. That's the whole point. You can't be putting in anything underneath the lamina that's compressing the already compromised spinal cord, because that's what makes patients paraplegic from the laminectomy, which I'm going to show you shortly. And then anterior central discs can also require a transthoracic approach or a thoracotomy, where you're coming in laterally, you're taking off the rib, the head of the rib, and you're removing the ventral aspect of that vertebral body. This is classically what's used for your calcified ventral disc herniations, but the extracavitary approach can also be effectively used for that. One of the main points of the talk, and if everybody falls asleep for the rest of the session, don't do a laminectomy with a thoracic disc. It shouldn't be used for a lateral, an anterolateral, or a central dash anterior thoracic disc, where you should use a transpedicular, costotransversectomy, extracavitary, or transthoracic approach. And here, again, to emphasize, don't do the laminectomy. Here are your options: the transpedicular, the costotransversectomy, the lateral extracavitary, or the transthoracic approach. So if you're listening to this talk and you're thinking, well, what should I bother remembering? Just remember this picture. And everything else you can forget. But if that thoracic disc comes along, just reconsult the literature and reconsult this talk to try and reorient yourself as to how it's handled. This is a typical illustration of a thoracic laminectomy. You're removing the spinous process on the lamina on both sides. Here, you can see the facet joints are being preserved. I've provided you a summary of the literature. I'm just going to show you there are multiple papers that we're going to summarize shortly. But there's a lot of literature out there, and it's gone on for years. And I'll show you one going back to 1985 at least, which emphasizes for decades it has been known, do not do a laminectomy to treat a thoracic disc herniation. And this is just going to keep coming up again and again. It doesn't matter if you're doing it minimally invasive, microendoscopically, et cetera. It is the wrong operation for a thoracic disc. And again, here's your illustration of your, typical laminectomy and your removal of the lamina. No matter what technique you're using to remove the lamina, you're still more likely than not going to damage the spinal cord in doing that. Here is a study by Arce et al. In 1985. And to summarize their findings, neurological worsening was attained with a laminectomy. Russell et al. In 89, 67 cases. Transthoracic and costotransversectomy procedures were equally effective. Laminectomy, not advised. Okay, and again, here's your laminectomy illustrated here and here. Oftentimes, you're combining it with a fusion to maintain stabilization. But again, contraindicated procedure for a thoracic disc. Sangunas' study in 92, 14 cases. Again, here, costotransversectomy and some of the other approaches were equally effective. Laminectomy, contraindicated. Fessler, 1998, in Surgical Neurology. Morbidity was similar for most procedures other than laminectomy. Quote, laminectomy does not provide adequate access for the safe removal of these lesions being thoracic discs. Chan et al., 2000, laminectomies are, not being performed. Chu et al., 2002, posterior laminectomy was abandoned currently as it's too likely to result in neurological loss. And then they favored doing these other approaches that we're talking about. Here's an example of why laminectomy is the negligent operation. Here's a myelogram CAT scan, okay? Here's a CT of the vertebral bodies 10 and 11. and you can see the ventral disc herniation. This is a myelogram CAT scan. You can see the dye, and the dye has disappeared and is compressed by the ventral disc herniation. Here you can see CSF is present posteriorly. You do a decompression posteriorly, you're not doing anything for the anterior compressive lesion. So just in case you don't believe the image that I'm showing you here, here is a figurative diagram of basically illustrating a massive anterior disc herniation, okay, compressing the cord dorsally. Okay, now the reason I'm showing you that, other than to again show you with these different papers, again, that laminectomy is not the option that you want to use. Laminectomy has not been a viable option for decades, so there's a high risk of paralysis. But that basically, when you do a laminectomy, or you do any operation where you're doing a laminectomy, the keratin punch or the keratin rongeur has a typical 3 to 5 millimeter bite. And this is the bite that we're talking about. It's right at the end here. This happens to be 4 millimeters in this illustration, but there are others. I mean, we had 1 millimeter keratin punches as well. But the problem is with these, no matter which keratin you're using, no matter which bite, you are introducing with a laminectomy, you are introducing that device below the lamina. Okay, you already have a very compromised compressed spinal cord. No matter what the bite plate of that keratin punch happens to be, you're going to be compressing or you're adding to the compression of that cord and potentially damaging the cord. You know, in lots of cases, they're using somatosensory evoked potentials, and the SEPs will just directly drop out and typically won't come back. But a rongeur placed under the lamina directly injures the cord. That's why you do not do a thoracic laminectomy. Here's the MyeloCT image that I showed you. Here's the figurative diagram of the large central disc. Here's the rongeur bite, in this case, an illustration of 4 millimeters, but it could be smaller. But here's what's happening. What you're doing is you're placing the bite underneath the lamina. Okay, you're compressing the cord, you're manipulating dorsal to that very compromised cord. Your SEPs are going to drop out, your cord is going to be damaged by doing this. So, a bite of any rongeur doing a laminectomy with a thoracic disc is going to compromise your cord and it's going to produce or contribute to cord damage. Not the way to do these cases. And here's just some information. I had summarized this in 2023, the average age for patients with thoracic discs. Between the age of 48 to 50, 50, to 56, with some other references thrown in, but you can just look at the SNI article, download it for free. All of our articles are free to download. And what, Jim, 234 countries at this point?
Yeah, 239, sure.
Wow. Okay. So the clinical presentations for thoracic discs: pain, myelopathy, myeloradiculopathy, and bladder loss. So pain between, you know, 50 to 75%, myelopathy between essentially 50 and 99%, and myeloradiculopathy 61%, with about a third at least showing radiculopathy and a quarter showing bladder dysfunction. So a lot of these patients have a lot of symptoms. They don't have to exhibit all the symptoms at the same time. It's just like when you talk about Cold Aquinas syndrome. They can have a partial Cold Aquinas syndrome. Here you can have partial loss of neurological function. It doesn't have to include all of the factors at the same time. So the first operative procedure we're just going to review is the transpedicular resection of the lateral disc. And here you just see that, you know, this is the pedicle, the lateral aspect of the pedicle, and you're going directly down that pedicle. You're going to drill down the pedicle, and for the lateral disc, you're going to start using your downbiting curette to morcellate not only the remains of the bony pedicle and resect that with the pituitary, but also components of the disc itself and the annulus. And here again, transpedicular approach. You're only removing the bone really over the facet. You're not really doing a laminectomy. So you're not really doing lamina removal over the cord. It's just very lateral over the facet, just where the pedicle is. This figurative diagram is not absolutely correct, just so that you can expose where the pedicle is very, very laterally.
So the transverse process in that picture remains.
The transverse process, yes, that remains. The rib remains. The rib affixation to the vertebral body remains. You're just removing the pedicle here because the disc herniation is supposed to be just next to or adjacent to the pedicle. This is again for a very lateral or foraminal disc, and you're going to use that downbiting curette, to just morcellate the remains of the pedicle as well as the disc herniation that you're encountering.
Do you use a diamond drill in this also, or?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. In fact, I would always use a diamond drill. You don't want any of the cutting burrs to ratchet out and then all of a sudden take a piece of your spinal cord by mistake.
So the rongeur is just to take additional bites and pieces out.
That's right.
Okay.
Very, very minimal. But you use curettes. Sometimes you'll use the upbiting curette in the pedicle itself. Once you get to the base of the pedicle, you'll use a downbiting curette to essentially deliver fragments of disc into the discal region here, and then to remove it directly.
Okay.
But every move is away from the cord, not towards it. Again, here is your lateral disc. You can use your downbiting curette for that lateral excision. I'm just using this diagram. This is actually a costotransversectomy, but here I'm just emphasizing to you that this is the pedicle that we're going to remove from here down to here. That's to remove the pedicle here. And the bony removal is only very laterally over the facet and really not over the cord. Again, not perfectly illustrated, but that's as close as I could get. When you look at transpedicular procedures, the average OR time, blood loss, length of stay, and reoperation rates. Here was a study by Sawai et al. In 21, 43 thoracic discs, average operative time, a little more than 3 hours, average blood loss, 238 cc's, average length of a hospital stay, 4.4 days. I mean, these days, it's very rare that we have patients who are really staying that long. Reoperation rate, 14%. Well, probably if you choose the correctly extensive operation the first time around, you're going to have fewer reoperations. So that's what I would say for here. This has to be a very lateral and foraminal disc to choose a transpedicular approach.
Can I ask you a question here?
Yeah.
One of the problems is how do I know I'm at exactly the right level where the disc is? Because before surgery, you put a needle in, you take a do you take you take a lateral X-ray? Do you put some dye in there? How do you know? Because I think there are reports of people who actually go to the wrong level.
Yes.
So how
It's
do you
a very
solve that?
common mis yeah, a very common mistake in the thoracic spine. First of all, before you ever go to the operating room, you're supposed to get a chest X-ray as well as a lumbar X-ray, and you look at the AP views to make sure you have 12 thoracic vertebra and you've got 5 lumbar vertebra. Now, 5% of the time, you may have 4 lumbar vertebra or 6 lumbar vertebra, so you have to make sure that your count on your preoperative studies is correct. Preoperatively, get an MR and a CT scan, and even a Milo CT scan to make sure you are correctly localizing where the disc herniation is before you even go to the operating room. Some people will, prior to doing any thoracic procedure, do a localizing film that morning, use methylene blue or some of the other things, or actually, sometimes they put a small pledge lid of metal right opposite the pedicle of interest. But then in the OR, you have to prone, do fluoro, and count up. You have to count up the ribs. Now, that's why you have to make sure you've counted the ribs correctly. And you have your preoperative chest X-ray to help tell you that, and your preoperative lumbar film to make sure you're not making any numerical mistakes. But
Using
sometimes
methylene blue.
injecting the intraspinous ligament at that level can help you out also.
Yeah, just using methylene blue, is that 100% certain?
Absolutely not. It can spread. They can inject too much, and you can end up, a level above, a level below. So that's why you have to, the best way is to correctly count the thoracic pedicles on your AP fluoro image as you sequentially go from the 12th rib to the 11th to the 10th, et cetera. You have to count your way up.
Okay, that's really important.
Yes, but it is a very common adverse event associated with these procedures. And it can be avoided, but it takes a lot of planning preoperatively as well as intraoperatively to make sure or ensure that you're not at the wrong level. A lot of the transpedicular approaches, look, you do have the thoracic spine and the rib cage that's going to uphold you together. Many still think that you need an interbody fusion if you're going to do a transpedicular approach, and some will place, different kinds of interbody devices in the site itself and then put pedicle screws posteriorly as well. This may be true as you get closer to the thoracolumbar junction. In the mid-thoracic spine, it may be certainly less necessary to require that. MR scans, they're the best at showing the location of your thoracic discs. Myelogram CAT scans, I'm going to show you next, are also excellent for doing that. Non-contrast CAT scans may be unreliable, but where your disc is going to be located. About 30% of your discs in the thoracic spine are going to be central or anterior. Anterolateral, some series vary, 50 to 100%, and lateral, that's a huge variation, 6 to 70%. So it depends on the study you read, the size of the study, but the locations can vary markedly. Certainly, I think the majority are going to be your anterolateral disc herniations. And again, the costotransversectomy here and your lateral extracavitary approaches are going to be the safest. Choosing just to do the transpedicular is probably the least safe in terms of giving you very limited access and maneuverability. And many people think these days that, the transthoracic has a very, very high morbidity. So costotransversectomy and the extracavitary are going to be really the favorite choices to a large degree.
Can you go back a minute? That slide said it was 6 to 70% lateral. That's a kind of
Yes.
big range. Why is that?
That's huge. I think it's the size of the different studies that are submitted.
I
They
see.
just said, hey, we have a series and all six of our cases were thoracic, or 6 out of 7 were lateral thoracic discs. So it's a variation in terms of the size of the different groups. I think
Okay.
the truth is probably somewhere in between, around 30 or 40%.
Okay.
Anterolateral discs, typically, as I've already mentioned, costotransversectomy is very popular. You remove the pedicle, the head of the rib, and then the rib itself. And here again is your large anterolateral thoracic disc herniation. It's impinging foraminally on your exiting root, but there's also some compression on your cord as well. So you need more room to go through the costotransversectomy approach to dissect that disc laterally. So for the costotransversectomy, you're going to remove basically the transverse process and the lamina very laterally over the facet and the transverse process. Well, it's really a transverse process here, more so than just the facet. And then you're going to remove the pedicle, and you're going to remove the lateral aspect of the vertebral body, but in this area up here. So again, an illustration of the anterolateral disc, and this again showing you pedicle removal, the head of the rib, and also the rib itself, and also the transverse process affixing to that rib. And once you have done the resection, you should have a pretty good, very lateral view. And here, then you can start dissecting material laterally, away from the cord, away from the nerve tissue, and into the sort of the crevice that you're creating or the defect that you're creating. And here is again, just to remind you, you're taking off the pedicle, the head of the rib itself, as well as the transverse process. And then this is what it's going to look like on a postoperative CAT scan. So here, really, your lamina is intact. You're going lateral to that. Okay, you're taking off the rib is coming in here. You've removed the transverse process. You've removed the pedicle, and you remove the head of the rib and the anterolateral portion of the vertebral body. It's not the costotransversectomy that comes all the way down, where you've dissected all the way down here through the soft tissues. But this gives you a very lateral exposure for that anterolateral disc. Again, all of your maneuvers are away from the cord. That's why when you do these procedures, you should be using not only somatosensory evoked potentials, which monitor the back of the cord, position, vibration, the posterior columns, but motor evoked potentials are going to monitor the alpha motor neurons, anterolateral spinal thoracic tracts, but basically motor. So you need motor evoked potentials as well as somatosensory evoked potentials when you do these cases. If you start to get changes, you halt, you stop, you raise the blood pressure, you can hyperoxygenate your wound with peroxide. If there's any distraction or manipulation, you stop whatever you're doing. If you have not created enough of a decompression, make yourself more room, okay? And wait. Probably give a bolus of a gram of Solu-Medrol. Sometimes you want to give two, but you don't just keep working your way through, okay?
Good, very good, good image.
So, what's the difference between CTs and MRs? I mean, pretty much include this in almost every lecture, just in case we have other folks who are not familiar with this. Basically, an MR scan is going to show you the soft tissues in the thoracic spine. You've got disc, you've got CSF, you've got fat, you've got ligament, you've got cysts, etc. CAT scan is going to show you calcium or the hard candy shell, the calcified disc, and the bone itself. So, again, on an M&M, you've got the chocolate on the inside, the hard candy shell on the outside, and that's your MR and your CAT scan, just in case any of your colleagues are forgetting that. Most thoracic discs herniations are the way, by the way, between T11 and T8, and the MR is going to best show the soft tissue findings for this. And here is your anterior thoracic disc seen on this sagittal MR, and here's an axial MR that excellently shows you the cord compression. So here's the thoracic disc, and here's your cord tethered over it. Okay. In some cases, you may have a lot of CSF posteriorly. In this case, you also have some epidural fat. In other cases, there's going to be less room present. But the MR best shows you soft tissues, the disc, the stenosis, the ligament, the cysts. High cord signals are seen in the cord, indicating the severity of the compressive changes. You may see edema associated with it. It may document for you the cord compression, the best, which you're not going to see on certainly on a non-contrast CAT scan. And an MR scan is not going to show you the calcification. It's going to show you a negative image of anything that is calcified. And that's very different from having a positive image. Positive image you're going to see on a CT or a Milo CT. Milo CT, obviously, by placing dye into the thecal sac, you're going to get the best delineation of this. It also helps you, very importantly, prevent wrong level surgery because you know exactly where that is. And you're doing a laminectomy here. I mean, wrong. You're doing your Milo CT, you're doing it from the bottom up so that you can count correctly as to where you are. CAT scan alone can show you the calcified thoracic disc. And in this case, this was colored in one case. Here's the vertebral bodies anteriorly, calcified disc opposite the disc space, lamina posteriorly. And just look at this. Look at there's no room left here. Because again, you're going to have a millimeter or two or three of epidural fat and dura and hypertrophied ligament, et cetera. You put a kerosene punch underneath here with a laminectomy, you're going to compress or demolish what's left of the cord in that case. So, fully calcified discs, about 40 to 65% of the time, partially calcified up to 27%. So, you're going to see some calcified discs. Also, sometimes your Milo CT is going to show you that the disc has herniated intradurally. That's a good reason not to pursue necessarily the anterior thoracic or thoracotomy approach, because then you're going to have trouble dealing with the CSF leak component of that. A CT scan, this is just an example of a CT showing calcification of a thoracic disc herniation. The MR does not show the calcification of this disc herniation, because on this MR, you're just seeing a hypo-intense signal for what is ossified or calcified. You do see the compressive effect, and here you can see the cord is vastly indented from this ventral thoracic disc herniation. But again, a good example of where it's judicious to get a CT scan, much less a Milo CT in some of these cases, basically all these cases. Extracavitary approaches. Again, if you've started, if you've been out there and sleeping, join us. Large anterior lateral thoracic disc can also be approached through a extracavitary procedure. And here again is your large central anterior disc. Again, extracavitary procedures, that's where they are on this schedule here. Here's an anterolateral disc on your Milo CT. And here's on a Milo CT. This was not the best study I could find, but it is not the worst. So you can see here is the disc herniation. You can see here barely a little bit of spinal fluid in the dural sac, and here you can see CSF in the dural sac, and then it disappears. But here is your large anterolateral disc, just like you're seeing it on the figurative diagram. You do not have a lot of room to work in. And obviously, the choice of which side you're going to go into has to deal with the side of the major component of that disc, because that's where the resection is going to have to be. So again, your extracavitary, you're going to go from here, take out this and this, so that you're working all throughout there. And that's what I'm showing you here. You're taking out not only the pedicle, you're taking out the transverse process, you're taking out a good portion of the rib and where the rib affixes to the thoracic vertebral body, and a huge portion of that vertebral body itself. And that's why in many of these instances, you're going to put in an interbody graft to make sure that, you can shore up that level, make sure it doesn't, kyphose. So again, extracavitary approaches, you have to take off the lateral muscles, and then from underneath the rib, you're going to have to take down the pleura in order to expose that vertebral body adequately. This is with the muscles removed. You're going to see your transverse process, you're going to see the rib, and then you're going to proceed from there. Okay, you're going to take out the rib and you're going to disarticulate and take out the head of the rib. You have to cut the rib first in order to do that. And then what you're going to do underneath here is you're going to dissect the pleura away. But again, this is probably a better diagram of some of this, but see where this retractor is? It really should be more medial, because you want to take some of the transverse process where it affixes to the rib, where it affixes to the pedicle here as well. So the diagram is not perfect, but it just shows you the separation of the pleura. Once you've completed the extracavitary approach, you should have an excellent anterolateral decompression of the cord as well as the nerve roots. So you have much, much more room here to work in. Okay. And, hopefully you've kept the pleura intact, so you're not compromising the lung in this case. Transthoracic approaches, on the other hand, may be dealing with your anterolateral discs as well as with your large central discs. Everybody argues that the morbidity of transthoracic approaches, makes many people avoid them, favoring favoring the extracavitary procedures. So, and here, just I'm showing you a Milo CT scan showing you a giant intradural disc herniation here on the non-contrast CT alone. Here on the MR, you never would have anticipated that, and a Milo CT is going to show that to you very well. Giant thoracic discs are seen about 30 to 40% of the time. That means that they're taking up 30 to 40% of the canal, and the frequencies vary markedly. It depends on, again, the series that you're looking at in the literature, and here are some of the different series that report different frequencies. Here's an illustration of an anterior thoracic disc. I'm representing to you that this is a disc herniation ventrally, centrally at T10/11. And then here is an MRI scan of a large thoracic disc, central anterior. And then here the image that I showed you previously of the large central Milo CT of that disc herniation. So figurative diagram to MR to myelogram CAT scan. Okay, here, figurative diagram over here, actual Milo CT here. And again, just remember the big blue disc herniation, you have to get that out safely. And that's where your transthoracic procedure may come in. You have to choose which side you're going to go from. Here's just a figurative diagram of everything you have to go to get there. So it's a long way in. Transthoracic approach requires, the ipsilateral thoracotomy. You're going to be taking out rib, disarticulating the head of the rib. Lots of times you're taking out the pedicle as well to get all of the approach. You've got to do a retropleural dissection of that lung to try and then expose the lateral aspect of that vertebral body. And again, you're going to be trying to go after that calcified disc with your downbiting curette, trying to avoid a CSF leak. And again, you have to be prepared in some of these cases. Are you going to need a lumbar drain once you're done with this? Sometimes people will put in a wound peritoneal shunt for this. We certainly do in the cervical spine. But for the transthoracic resection, you will put in basically screws into the vertebral body in order to distract that interspace and get down to the spinal canal. This is the resection. You're going to go through the pedicle, the head of the rib, and take out the base of the canal itself. Here's a lateral view of your exposure using your downbinding curette. Everything, all the section is away from the cord itself. Okay, and then at the end, you're going to place some kind of an interbody device as well as a lateral plate on the vertebral bodies, which of course you can do the same facsimile of this with the costotransvasectomy. Again, here's an example of a large central disc herniation on an MRI scan. Here you've removed it and you've got the graft here and then the plate. And then this is what your plate may look like on that MR, obviously with artifact, but now your cord is decompressed at that level. There may be a residual high signal in that cord associated with that. But here your post-op MR shows your graft and plate in place. And here again, your post-operative view of your procedure. You've done your resection as best you can, and you have a view of the cord and the nerve roots. What are the outcomes of the transthoracic and transfacet procedures? In Curia's series, they were all anterolateral discs and they did transthoracic approaches. This was back in 1994, good to excellent outcomes, 86% of the time. Silverman et al., this was a later 1998 study, 87% approved, and most of the 60% were transthoracic procedures. And what were some of the adverse events? Well, one patient died, there was one cardiac event, and one patient developed paralysis. So they're not without risks and complications. Again, somatosensory evoked potentials as well as motor evoked are critical to use in these cases. Here is another study of transthoracic, 70% good results, actually from both of these studies, that minimally invasive transthoracics, may have more complications. Longer surgery, more blood loss, and longer lengths of stay. Kapoor's study of mostly transthoracic, but some other transpedicular, a little more than half, a little less than half improved, half stayed the same, and a subset of patients became worse. The major events, dural tears, massive blood loss intraoperatively, and delayed complications can be delayed plegia, herniation of the cord, spinal fluid leaks, infections, etc. So these can really present with some significant morbidity. Again, a lot of these thoracic procedures are going to be supplemented with pedicle screw instrumentation. Pedicle screws can be placed percutaneously, minimally invasively, or open. Again, you have to remember if you're putting minimally invasively these screws, the tubes are 3 to 9 centimeters long. Tubes themselves vary between 16 to 26 millimeters wide, and 1 inch is 25 millimeters. So here's your, your thoracic pedicle screw instrumentation. And this is what it's supposed to look like, your screws nicely placed bilaterally, et cetera. And here, screws may be nicely placed. And in this case, I just, chose to borrow actually from the lumbar literature. And here is a screw coming across the spinal canal. That's not good form. This is a thoracic study where the CT scan on the parasagittal images showed the screw beyond the vertebral body. And it was confirmed on the axial study. And they did a barium swallow esophagram. And they diagnosed that that screw had penetrated the esophagus. So obviously it had to be removed and the entire patient had to undergo a major revision surgery. So basically, when you're talking about thoracic discs, stop, think, look at the literature, choose the right surgeon to perform the operation. If it's not you, if you haven't done it before, don't do it alone. Do it with help. Watch, learn. Don't just have that patient be your first patient where it's like, you go to a meeting and you're ready to go ahead and do it at home. Choose the right operation for that thoracic disc herniation based on your studies. I just want to point out to you that if you look in Surgical Neurology International 2023, I have a summary article. Look at the reference list And this is just one of the, that's half the reference list. Here's the other. It goes back to 1995 and it goes up to 2023. Again, laminectomy is the wrong operation for thoracic discs. And here are the multiple references that I'm giving you. In this reference, it was 67 cases. Transthoracic and costochransvasectomy are the most equally effective. Laminectomy is ill-advised. 14 cases in this study in 92, laminectomy is contraindicated. Fessler study in 98, laminectomy contraindicated. Chen study 2000. Again, the other procedures are effective. None or a few patients underwent laminectomy. World Neurosurgery 2018, Sevakumaran said basically, don't do the laminectomy, and so on and so forth. This was 2023. Laminectomy is no longer considered a viable option for treating thoracic disc herniations. And here it just happens to be one talking specifically about costotransvasectomy. So in short, basically, these are very difficult operations. Make sure you have the correct monitoring going into these procedures. Make sure you have the appropriate preoperative studies, MR and CT and/or myelogram CAT scan. Make sure you actually mark, as Jim and I were discussing, mark that patient preoperatively that morning before you go to the operating room to try and make sure you're going to be in the right place at the right time. Watch out if you're using methylene blue or any of the others. Don't inject a lot of material because you have to inject it into the intraspinous ligament, very punctate, very focal. And again, it does not take the place of counting up the ribs on an AP fluoro image from the lumbar spine all the way into the thoracic spine to make sure you're operating at the correct level. But this is what it takes to do these operations correctly and safely. And if you follow these directions, it should really help you do these well and get the best results for your patients. Thank you.
And Nancy, it's just a superb review of the subject. Let me ask you a few questions that I had as I was going. It's pretty obvious that once you get this disease, which is rare, so you're not going to see it a lot,
Right.
you got yourself a very complex problem that's difficult to manage. And so all the things I'm going to ask are going to follow up on that. Obviously, you got to get a CT and MR. Should you also get a Milo CT? I mean, if you go with what people used to say before, is you need all the information you can get before you do the surgery. Would you do them all, or what would you do?
I think, I Milo CT might be great for, lateral or foraminal discs. Once you get into these bigger disc herniations, central or anterolateral, you can start to worry that you do a myelogram and that patient could decompensate.
Okay, very good.
So you have to be very circumspect in terms of where you choose to do that. That's where you might just get the non-contrast CAT scan. Talk to your radiologist. I can't emphasize to you how many cases are lost, medical legally or botched because nobody took the time to go to their neuroradiologist, go over the MR, go over the CAT scan, go over, just plain X-rays. Did you get everything you needed to localize that problem before you did anything? And then before you go to that OR, do yourself a favor in the thoracic spine, have that level marked by the radiologist. And then in addition to that, you want to make sure that you are counting up the ribs correctly to make sure that you're at the right level.
Okay, that's good. And the next thing you talked about is, as we talked about, is emphasizing counting, because I just can't rem I can't forget, in my training, people would always say, "Geez, I was at the wrong level,"
Yes.
and that's I've seen that happen in the lumbar level. So you've got to really be sure about that. Now, the next thing is, let me get to this subject first. The next thing is, if you're going to do a costotransvasectomy, do you need to talk to your thoracic surgeon or not? I mean, in other words, when do you need to ask for somebody to come in? Because the risks are going up as I start talking about all these things.
Right.
You need some supporter or somebody who at least can help you through this.
Yeah, I mean, you need definitely to talk to your anesthesiologist. Sometimes they will separately intubate the main bronchus on the right and the left,
Oh my.
because if your lung is collapsed down on one side because you get it intrapleurally, then you have to be ready to anticipate that and deal with that. So definitely you have to talk to anesthesia.
What about the thoracic surgeon? Would you do it for a costotransfersectomy or
You could. I don't think it's absolutely essential. I think it's certainly helpful because they're used to peeling ribs off the pleura. So
That's a good
if you don't have an experienced surgeon who's done thoracic discs before, and you have not done these well, definitely a thoracic surgeon is it behooves you. I mean, it's just like for any surgery, you know, certainly the anterior lumbar interbody fusions, et cetera, to have an access surgeon involved, ready to help you. And also, they know how to prepare and speak to the anesthesiologist because they're doing this kind of exposure all the time. So that's a very good idea.
Now it would also because you would you convert the costotransversectomy into more of an anterior procedure, so you may have to do more dissection would be another reason you need to have somebody there
Yes,
rather than saying,
because
I didn't have him, he was not there, I had to do it myself, I couldn't quit.
no. And you really need the experience of a qualified, really thoracic surgeon to be there to help you. Also, in case you get extra bleeding that you're not used to dealing with. I mean, that can be a real problem. And
Good problem.
how to get the lung out of the way safely.
And evoked potentials also, you mentioned that early on, but these are all things along the way that ensure that you're going to have a successful outcome.
Yes.
And
Right, but it's all the planning. In other words, how many, you know, if you look at malpractice cases, how many of the errors, or it's like the mental errors in baseball, they didn't have an arterial line in place. That was a mistake. They didn't have the SEP and motor evoked potential monitoring, because the motor evokes are going to show you if the anterior portion of the spinal cord is being damaged. SEPs may never drop out. So you really have to have the two of them there.
you have to
They've
have
done
both.
studies in monkeys where they actually removed the anterior two-thirds of the spinal cord and they left the posterior one-third intact, and the motor evokes dropped out, but the somatosensory stayed intact. So you have to have all of these other adjuncts in place. But
They're
I think,
very, very good points.
emphasizing the thoracic access surgeon is a very good emphasis.
The minimally invasive surgery. I'm not, you can help me out here because I'm not familiar with that. Are people trying to approach these with minimally invasive surgery and tubes and all that kind of stuff?
All the time. And all I can tell you is it just seems to me that a lot of these approaches are fraught with a lot more risks and complications. If you can't see what you're doing and you're getting less than adequate exposure and trying to do, I mean, the literature basically shows after a year, you know, with the smaller incisions versus larger incisions, a lot of the results tend to be relatively similar. But the comorbidities seen with some of these endoscopic or microendoscopic or minimally invasive procedures, the risks are higher. I mean, it's just like in the lumbar spine, minimally invasive discectomies, more CSF leaks, more infections, because it's taking you longer to get where you have to go because you can't get there as readily and quickly. You know, mistakes in terms of localization mistakes and residual discs, recurrent discs, that kind of thing. So I think you've got to be very careful in terms of when to apply a minimally invasive, much less a microendoscopic approach.
So you don't go to a course and do a endoscopic approach and come home and do that on your next patient.
Well, that's done all the time, unfortunately, right? It's, you know, see one, do one, teach one, but that's a real mistake. In other words, if you go to a course and you see this done, there have been instances where in the same hospital, let's say you had neurosurgery and orthopedics, and you know, all you had to do was ask your orthopod in the next room to come and do a few cases with you to make sure that you know how to do it adequately. So you do it with them as co-surgeons, so you really learn how to do the case correctly. Instead, ego gets in the way and your patient suffers for it.
Well, you know, I look at it as this is really a procedure fraught with a lot of risk. You're into parts of the anatomy you don't see all the time. You're into an area where there's very little room for error. And it would seem to me, if I was just thinking about it, I'd want as much visualization as I could get.
Yes.
If I was using a tube, I'm really pretty restricted. I'm not an expert in that. I don't mean
Yeah.
to criticize people, but I'm just looking at it from what are the statistical chances of having a high degree of success rate? And I'd have to have a lot of vision, particularly if this is not a common procedure. You don't do this often.
Right.
If you're in a center where you do 20 a year or something like that, it's a you've got a different argument. But this is trouble waiting to happen.
Yeah, well, it's like going to the courses with the cervical foraminotomy, microendoscopic or cervical foraminotomies, and your maneuverability, even if it's a relatively short, travel from the skin to actually the bone itself, your restricted ability to maneuver, your nerve root that's extending laterally and superiorly, typically. Getting the maneuverability under that nerve, getting your dissector, dissecting it away from the pathology, getting your curette in safely. These techniques, especially through the tubes, can be very, very limiting.
And if I got, let's say, it was taken this, I'm taking this central disc out, and in the process, I tore the dura and I got a CSF leak.
Yeah.
Now what do I do?
Well, number one, doing a repair is going to be very difficult.
Right.
Number two, you should not put in DuraSeal or your fibrin sealants because they're going to be cord compressive. So that's not a smart way to do it. You can always, use a artificial dura or, some fascia on the way in. But the main thing is, lots of these cases can be treated with wound peritoneal shunts. So you directly divert CSF into the peritoneal cavity. And then once you're done with the case, you can put in a lumbar drain or immediately put in a lumboperitoneal shunt with what's called a horizontal vertical valve so that as soon as they stand up, they don't lose all this CSF.
So I'm thinking about this, and I look at surgery, and I pack some stuff in there, and hope it's going to get better. And after surgery, I got a CSF leak. I got to take the patient back to surgery. I got to go through everything all over again. Then I got to put a drain in. I probably have to inspect where the leak is and see what I can do. I've still got my thoracic surgeon with me. I mean, I don't want to go down that road. So that's
Yeah.
complicated life.
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest mistakes, though, is that everybody then, to occlude the leak, they throw in the kitchen sink. Yeah, you throw in your DuraGen. Well, then you throw in some gel foam. And gel foam's the worst thing to leave there because it swells like 12% in all directions. And then before you know it, the patient postoperatively is paraplegic because they all compress the spinal cord.
Yeah.
And DuraSeal is well known to do that, as are the other fibrin sealants. So you have to
Well,
be prepared to deal with this. And typically, putting in a diverting shunt is going to be the way to go.
it's you've gone over this procedure. It's obviously a complex procedure, and it has risks. And if you do your homework and do all the preventative things before you get in there, I don't think you're trying to discourage people, but it's something you just have to be prepared for, and it can be done. But if you need all these extra support, there's nothing wrong with asking a thoracic surgeon, getting multiple films, making sure you're at the right space, getting the evoked potentials and motor and sensory, and being careful how you use your instruments, because each one of those things can get you in trouble.
Yes. And again, most importantly, if you haven't done it before, find a surgeon who has.
Yeah. Just another terrific summary, the terrific graphics, and it made it really understandable, I think, for the audience and for me, and really appreciate
Okay, my pleasure.
it. Okay. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as a diagnosis or treatment of a health problem, or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. At the end of this video, please fill out your evaluation of this program. And these recorded sessions are available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions, comments, or request for CME credit to ausman@snidigital.org. There are many ways to learn. SNI, Surgical Neurology International, is a 2D internet journal. Nancy Epstein is the editor-in-chief. Its web address is sni.global. SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is a 3D live video journal. It's interactive with discussion. Its web address is snidigital.org, and both are free 24/7, 365 for everyone everywhere. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territories. It's been published for 14 years. It's the third most widely read 2D journal in neurosurgery. SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is now read in 105 countries within 4 months and is a new 3D video journal. The goal is to help people throughout the world. Medical News Network is a news network devoted to bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. These programs are supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation. Copyright 2024, all rights reserved. Thank you for watching this program. We hope you enjoyed it.